You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show here on this Wednesday, October 5th. My pleasure to be with you. Hope your day's starting off well. Hump day, as they call it. And actually, for some in this area, not just hump day, fall break coming up. So short week indeed. Those are always fun. Got a lot to talk about today. Bottom of the hour, my guest will be Inez San Martin. Inez, who works for Crux, taking the Catholic Pulse, a Catholic Journalistic Association there in Rome. She is originally from Argentina, but has been a regular guest on the program. She works closely with John L. Allen Jr., someone I also deeply respect. Inez, going to be talking about a recent trip that she took with the Pope, actually flying with the Pope, as she tends to do, so she would have had firsthand account of his famous plane interviews. She was also there in Georgia, something I talked about yesterday, a unique experience from what we are used to with popes, Pope Francis giving a mass in virtually an empty stadium, as many of the Orthodox Christians there in Georgia reneged on an earlier promise to attend. So we get her take on that trip, and also just her ear to the ground on any other thing that's going on in Rome. And then in the second hour today, I'll be joined in the studio by a good friend of mine, retired police officer Joan Root. We'll talk some about her law enforcement perspective on the recent shootings in protests here, most recently in particular, in Tulsa, in Charlotte, and also in El Cajon, California. So I would imagine that she, as a police officer, retired police officer, trained in those situations, has a particular perspective on that. And that issue will actually drive our question of the day, which I'll give to you in the next segment. But if you want to chime in on anything that's on your mind, 573-4BREAD-4. We'd love to hear from you. 573-4BREAD-4. Or we'll email you, Mike Allen, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or post your thought on Facebook or on Twitter. A few other things we'll get to. The Onion giving evidence for purgatory. A very credible outfit there, right? Also, an interesting take on Nuremberg. More on the real presence and why popes need confronting to all that and more on the program today. Hope you had a good night. Last night, I finished up my marriage preparation class, which I teach regularly in my full-time work to a group of engaged couples. It was a little bit of as I said last week, anybody who's ever taught in a group setting knows this. So there's sort of a critical mass. You don't want too few people there. You don't want too many people there. Too many people, it's harder to keep attention. Too few, I don't know, people tend to clam up. They don't laugh at your jokes. And come on, who wouldn't laugh at my jokes? But this group was a little bit like that. Ask questions, no response. If I thought that they were old enough to have seen Ferris Bueller's Day Off, I would have given them the classic Ben Stein, Bueller, when I asked a question, but it didn't happen. But all in all, they were good spirits, and you know, they wrote positive things by and large on the evaluation. It's difficult. We kind of break for this particular edition of the marriage preparation course. This particular one, we broke it up into 2 weeks, two different Tuesday night classes and back-to-back weeks. And we did most of the, I would say, theological heavy lifting last week, because we orient the course really around these 2 points that Pope Pius XI made all the way back in 1930 in a letter he wrote about Christian marriage. And he essentially said that if couples want to know true joy in married life, which I would assume we all do, nobody enters into marriage seeking misery. But hopefully we also don't enter into marriage hoping that we can, through gritted teeth, gut it out to the end. I mean, God's desire for us is joy, right? So Pope Pius XI, who saw trends in marriage even then in 1930 that concerned him, he said, if couples want to know true joy in their married love, they need to do two things. Now, it sounds simple, like a late-night infomercial or something. But and it is simple, but just because something's simple doesn't mean it's easy, right? So the first point is couples should meditate upon God's plan for married life. The conviction being, of course, that if marriage is, in fact, not just a human institution, not just a societal construct, but is, in fact, a divine institution written into human nature by the one who created us, then he would have a plan for it, just as someone who manufactures a car will likely give you an owner's manual on how best to operate it. So that's the first thing. Couples should meditate upon God's plan for married life. And as I said to the couples, the first session we have together will be just that. And that's a lot of material. It's a lot of theological heavy lifting, seeing marriage where it fits within the whole scope. Hopefully it's very enlightening too. But then the second of the two things, couples, by the help of God's grace, and that's an important point because we always need God's grace. That's the beauty of the sacrament. There's a ready supply. He doesn't call us to live something he doesn't equip us to do. But with the help of God's grace, couples should shape all their ways of thinking and acting according to God's plan. And as I told them, it's simple, but it's not easy, and it's going to take the rest of your life to continually reflect upon what marriage is, what it means, what God's design for it is, and to seek to apply it. And you're going to come up short along the way. You're going to stumble. That's why we have confession. The important thing is we're on the journey. But it's always interesting because you see this shift take place between point one and point two. This meditating on God's plan for married life. It's really when you start to break it down and you begin to see it, it becomes one of those aha moments. When you begin to talk about marriage as a key really to understanding the whole salvation message and the whole Christian life. If you look at those marital bookends in Scripture with the original marriage that opens the biblical story, and then you have the marriage at the end of the biblical story, which is that union of Christ and his church and the wedding supper that St. John sees in his vision of heaven, which is really what the Eucharist is as well, a wedding meal. You begin to see this marital theme and God's desire for us to be in this sort of nuptial union. And when you begin to see it, things become apparent in Scripture that you've never seen before, like Jesus' first miracle being at a wedding, like John the Baptist referring to Jesus as the groom and he the best man, Jesus himself telling many, many parables in which a wedding feast is involved. Books like Hosea in the Old Testament, in which God's marriage with Israel is expressed through the marriage between Hosea and his unfaithful wife. And you go all through. It's like the scales fall from the eyes. That's beautiful. It's inspiring. You have one of those aha moments. But then you see that shift when all of a sudden, as we talked about last night, which was the second of the two-part series, we talked about sexual honesty within marriage or before marriage and sexual honesty within marriage. And as I told him, that key word there is honesty, not morality. We hear Catholic teaching, we think sexual morality feels like an arbitrary list of rules. Don't do X, Y, or Z. That's kind of how we imagined Catholic teaching on sexuality. When what it really is about sexual honesty. What do we mean? That it means recognizing the truth about our sexuality, why God made us male and female in his image, how it is in the sexual union that the nature of marriage is most fundamentally and consummatingly expressed, to consummate, to sum up, to perfect, and to complete. Once we understand the truth of who we are as male and female, as living icons that point in our marital union to the union of the Blessed Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and the union between Christ and his church, then once we know the truth about sex, then we need to seek to live in the truth, which is not easy because we have been, as we talked about last night, to live in the truth means to recognize how we've been shaped and formed to think about our sexuality, and to recognize even the distortions that are part of the air we breathe around us. And so it takes a serious self-assessment, but it also takes a courage and a repentance at times, and also a boldness to go forward and to say, Lord, help me by your grace to live this. So that's what we did. It's always an interesting shift because, like I said, you move from that light bulb, aha, to, I'm sorry, what was that? What does that mean? If that's true, then what? And so you begin to talk about difficult things like the dishonesty of sex between people who are not married. Not that they won't find some intimacy and some pleasure in it, but that at a fundamental objective level, it is a dishonest act, because if the language of the sexual union is marital language, I give my whole self to you, then outside of the marital context, that is always fundamentally dishonest. But it can be dishonest within marriage too. If we withhold some aspect of ourselves, or ask our spouse to withhold some aspect, or don't make a total gift of ourselves, or reduce the sexual union to simply an animalistic instinct instead of a free consent of persons, that's where the dishonest comes. We talk about things like contraception, sterilization, lust, pornography, a lot of hard stuff, but God's grace in the midst of it all, because we're all on a journey. That's the good news. We'll be back in a minute with more, including our question of the day. This is The Mike Allen Show. You are listening to Bread Box Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Media. Here in about 15 minutes, we'll be talking to Inez San Martin of Crux, taking the Catholic Pulse. She'll talk about her recent foray to Georgia and Azerbaijan. Pick that one out on a map. That's one of those, like, whatever, Tajikistan, or who knows. Where you can find it on the map, I don't know, but right there tucked there next to not the state of Georgia, but the country of Georgia, traveling with the Holy Father, and especially his trip to Azerbaijan, a very heavily Muslim country. Get her take on why the Holy Father decided to make that trip, and also his experience in Georgia, where he gave Mass to a virtually empty stadium. Not what we're typically used to. So look forward to that conversation. And then, as I said, the second hour, Joan Root, retired police officer with a law enforcement perspective on the recent shootings. My question of the day, and I posted a link to an article. It's an extensive article from Vanity Fair, what the data really says about police and racial bias. I have to say, it's not an easy article to read in terms of the information of the tendencies among law enforcement. And let's face it. I mean, I there is some truth to the fact. This came up last night, by the way, in the vice presidential debate, the whole issue of institutional bias. Now, I didn't watch all of the debate last night. I thought, by and large, it was a better debate to watch than the Clinton-Trump debate, I'll be honest with you. But the whole question came up about these shootings and institutional bias and systemic racism and all the rest. And the reference was made to something that Hillary Clinton said in the previous debate, that we're all biased. There is bias. And I think there is some truth to that. And we don't need to be afraid to admit it. I mean, we all have our biases. The problem is there systemic bias, institutional bias in law enforcement when it comes to how African Americans are treated. So this Vanity Fair article, there's a link to it on the show's Facebook page with the question of the day. You can read it for yourself. But 18 different studies that all point to pretty strong evidence for a racial bias, a tendency, even when cross-checked for the situations and context. There was one, I think it was study number 16 out of the 18 that they cited. This was a Stanford study of police practices in Oakland, California, found that officers were disproportionately handcuffing blacks. Regardless of the area of the city, disproportionate treatment by race was similar, and the raw totals were stunning, according to a Washington Post summary of the findings. 2,890 African Americans were handcuffed but not arrested in a 13-month period, while only 193 whites were cuffed. When Oakland officers pulled over a vehicle but didn't arrest anyone, 72 white people were handcuffed, while 1,466 African Americans were restrained. The researchers also found significant differences in the way officers spoke to African Americans. Using only the words an officer uses during a traffic stop, we can predict whether that officer is talking to a black person or a white person with 66% accuracy. So I'd be interested in your thoughts on that. Do you think there is systemic racism within our law enforcement? Not saying, you may say, yeah, there's some bad apples, but systemic. That I'll be interested to talk to Joan about that in the next hour. I will say this, you know, Charlotte released some more video footage, body cam, dash cam, of the shooting of Keith Lamont Scott. That, for me, is a very difficult video to watch, as is the one from Tulsa. Now, the one from El Cajon, I think, in which the accusation is that the one shot held up a vape device that looked like a gun, and therefore he was shot because of what appeared to be the threat that he was going to shoot someone. Video's a little inconclusive because it's kind of at a distance. But the other two, I think it's very troubling. It is. But like I said, that's why we have Joan on in the second hour. She's going to give us her own perspective on that. So you want to chime in on that? What do you think? Systemic racism, give us a call. 573-4BREAD-4. You can call or text. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post a response on Facebook or on Twitter. Let's see here. Looking at sports from last night, of course, playoff baseball began. Baltimore Orioles going down into the Toronto Blue Jays. Toronto Blue Jays evoking the ghosts of Joe Carter, 1993. Edwin Encarnacion with a walk-off home run in the 11th inning. So the Blue Jays will go on now to play the Rangers. The NL wildcard game will be today. The San Francisco Giants, who seem to be unbeatable in even-numbered years, they've won the last three World Series, and they got Madison Bumgarner, Mad Bum as they call him, heading to Citi Field to take on the Mets. You want to get rid of the Giants as quickly as you can, because the longer they linger, watch out, is all I'll have to say about that, and they could break some Cubs Hearts fans along the way. But anyway, one of the things last night from the Orioles game, and I did not watch that, but Buck Showalter, the Orioles manager, coming under some criticism for hanging on to his closer, Zach Britton. You know, there's always a debate on this. If you're tied, for example, going into the ninth inning, let's say you're playing the home team, so you're the visitor. Do you send your closer out there in a tie game at the bottom of the ninth? They're not going to get the save, right? Because it's tied. Your best hope is to get the extra innings, but then you don't have your closer in extra innings if they only pitch one inning. Or do you hold on to your closer until your team maybe finally gets the lead in the top of the inning to kind of finish it off? Buck Showalter holding on to Zach Britton in the 11th, choosing to use a starter in relief rather than Britton, and he gave up three hits, including Encarnacion's walk-off three-run blast. So Showalter coming under some criticism. That's the way it goes when you're a manager. Hindsight's 20/20, but I think there may be some validity there. Other things, Arnold Palmer with the memorial service yesterday. and being honored, including Ricky Fowler, which is pretty cool. You know, here you had Ryder Cup weekend, the U.S. finally breaking through against the Europeans with a big 17-11 win. Ricky Fowler bringing the trophy, the Ryder Cup, with him to the memorial service for Arnold Palmer, for the King, and bringing it there. So that's pretty cool. And rest in peace, Arnie. I was thinking yesterday a little bit about something we talked about on the show, the major coaching carousel that may happen after this season is over. Right, you've got LSU, who's already fired Les Miles. You've got Texas, who's looking more and more likely that they're going to part ways with Charlie Strong, and you go on down the list. Once you have teams at the top who make changes, then you got a lot of shuffling on down. It's sort of like in a diocese. When some priests at a couple of big parishes get moved, it sends a ripple effect all down the chain, and it's going to do that in college football. But here's the thing that I was thinking about yesterday, because I'm a Kentucky football fan. Kentucky, of course, is in a situation where their head coach, Mark Stoops, he may survive this season. I think it's going to come down to whether they beat Vanderbilt Saturday or not, to be honest with you. But if they decide to get rid of Mark Stoops after this year, they're going to have a decision to make. Do you go after Les Miles? Do you go after Charlie Strong? Both coaches who've had some success, but who fell out of favor with their elite program that they're coaching. My question is do you go after a coach like that? Because I think you'd be hard-pressed to find examples of where a coach at an elite football or basketball program did not measure up to the expectations of that school, went to a lower-tier school, and had tremendous success. Because I think what you find is that the problems or the shortcomings that derailed their success at the elite school, you know, wherever you go, there you are, will manifest themselves at a lower school that even has lower expectations. But for whatever reason, those shortcomings also make themselves known there. I've seen example after example after example, and I'll give you a couple of cases in point, right? Tubby Smith, we'll talk basketball, who had great success at the University of Kentucky, won a national championship, but kind of slid, never went back to a Final Four after his first year, and began to, not live up to elite program expectations. People thought he was treated unfairly and so forth, but the truth is Kentucky fans demand a certain high level of success. He wasn't bringing it, and so he left on his own, wasn't fired, but he went to Minnesota. They thought they were getting a steal, this coach who was not appreciated at the elite school. Well, what do you know? He started having difficulties at Minnesota until finally he was fired there, and now he's at Texas Tech. Seen it in other places as well. The great coach, Kentucky. We'll take Kentucky, for example. Hired Bill Curry after he was basically run out of town at Alabama. Had just won 10 games. People thought, how could Alabama be unhappy? We'll gladly welcome you to Kentucky. Well, a few years later, Bill Curry fired. That's my little caveat emptor when it comes to hiring Les Miles or Charlie Strong. Anyway, we'll put off our What Were You Thinking till later in the show. When we come back, Inez San Martin of Crux. This is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
We're right at the bottom of the hour. Welcome back into Breadbox Media. Mike Allen here on this Wednesday, October 5th. Pleased to be joined via Skype by Inez San Martin, an Argentinian journalist who covers the Vatican in Rome for Crux. She has been with us fairly regularly, almost monthly, and we're very appreciative of her work and the work that John L. Allen does with Crux, Taking the Catholic Pulse. Inez, hello.
Hello, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing well. Settled back in after a little traveling?
Well, it's hard to settle back in when you're following Pope Francis because there's always too much traveling taking place. So settling back in, you know, it's sort of hard to do, but definitely rested if that works in any way.
I guess he got back to Rome just in time for yesterday's feast day of his namesake, St. Francis.
Yes, we did. I mean, we technically landed Sunday night. But, you know, the day after a papal trip is usually wasted both for the Pope and for the journalist traveling with him because he takes such an exhausting tour whenever he leaves. Doesn't matter where he's going. We know it's going to be tiring. And if it's tiring for us, you know, I'm basically 30 years old and he's almost 80. So if I can barely keep up with him, I don't want to think what it feels like to be him during those trips. He's greeting people one by one.
I would imagine St. Francis of Assisi it's a big deal in Italy. He's one of the patrons, isn't he, of the country?
Yeah, he is one of the patrons of the country, you know, and it was very moving yesterday. I don't know if you saw Pope Francis going to Amatrice and the whole central Italian region where an earthquake hit almost a month ago. Now, it was very, very moving to see the Pope just going down there. It was a private visit. There was, you know, the very few images we got from the spokesperson of the Pope who was following him around and sharing very sort of specific snapshots of what the Pope was doing. It was incredibly moving to just see him praying in silent in front of this destroyed city, because Amatrice, where the famous Amatriciana sauce comes, is basically a city that is no more. So that was very moving. And, you know, to me, it's like yet another reason to admire the guy, because I was exhausted even yesterday, could barely get out of bed. And here he was traveling for hours to bring comfort and, you know, show closeness to thousands of people, because he greeted thousands yesterday. It's amazing. I don't know how he does it.
we'll credit the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, well, definitely. that's the only explanation.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Let's talk a little bit about a conference that the Vatican is putting on. Certainly something right up my alley, a world conference on sports and faith.
Yes, it is. It's sports put at the service of humanity. Basically, that's the idea. It's Pope Francis, in my opinion, Pope Francis at his best in trying to reach out, in this case specifically, to the world of culture through sports, because he knows that, you know, when you have, you know, we Argentinians, we are very much into soccer, just like you guys are into, you know, football or baseball. And when you're, you know, a sports player, it doesn't matter where you come from. You know, the color of your skin is, you know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't affect. If you're good, you're going to make the team. You're going to make the cut. And what Pope Francis right now is trying to work on is involving the people from the world of sports with the help of the Olympic Committee and the United Nations to try to get sportswomen and sportsmen from all around the world to be committed into, you know, acknowledging the fact that they are witnesses for the world. Because today in the United States, for instance, only 16% of Americans follow the world of science, but 80% of Americans follow sports. Either baseball, football, hockey, you name it, but they are there watching it every week. So what Pope Francis is trying to do is engage the players into being witnesses of hope, being witnesses of peace, being witnesses of nonviolence. So it's going to be a pretty intense conference. It starts today. Pope Francis will be there together with Ban Ki-moon, of course, the Secretary General of the United Nations, and the President of the Olympic Committee will also be there here at the Vatican, kicking up this conference that will last until Friday. It's probably going to be news in the next few days.
Well, here with Inez San Martin of Crux, talking to her live from Rome about the Pope's recent travels and this event, this conference on sports and faith. Of course, I'm a big sports fan, so that's right up my alley. Sounds like a great event. Let's talk about the Pope's recent trip. There are a lot, you know, if you were to probably poll a lot of people, at least here in the U.S., about geography. I'm not sure they could finger Georgia or Azerbaijan on a map. Certainly,
yeah. I mean, I think the sort of the geographical sort of keys I can give, which is it's part of the Caucasus region or it's next, mm-hmm. you know, surrounding the Caspian Sea. I'm not sure it really changes much for a lot of people. I personally definitely had to look it up in the map when we said, okay, we're going there. So where is this? Where is there?
Well, it got my
bad with all the giant countries.
It got my attention when I was reading your coverage, actually, initially of his trip to Georgia. We're used to the Pope going to places where there are a lot of Catholics and therefore huge crowds that gather, you know, and standing room only in the papal mass. But there were some images of
definitely not the case here.
The Pope celebrating, you know, Georgia, which is, I guess, heavily its Christian population, heavily Eastern Orthodox, and so he had a mass in a stadium.
Georgian Orthodox.
And there were, I guess, Orthodox who had planned, who said they were going to come to the mass. Then they were no shows, and so he gave mass, the Holy Father, in a relatively empty stadium.
Yeah, it was relatively empty. I mean, we're talking about a country that has 4 million people and only 100,000 of them are Catholic. So, you know, it's always interesting when Francis chooses his destinations. And his visit, although he was very warmly welcomed by Patriarch Ilya, who's the head of the Georgian Orthodox Church, and even the president of Georgia, the truth is, at the grassroots, the Orthodox weren't really happy with the visit. There were some people complaining about Francis coming to the country. But even seeing the empty stadium, I think it was beautiful to see both in Georgia and Azerbaijan, Pope Francis, you know, taking his time to be present for the very small Catholic communities that are today, you know, part of Eastern Europe. Because we sometimes forget just how privileged we are to live in, you know, Christian majority or Catholic majority in my case, because both Italy and Argentina are Catholic majority countries, where, you know, expressing our faith is normally something you can do in public and no one's going to, you know, look at you as, well, how do I put you into prison or how do I make sure you don't do this again next week? So in that sense, having Francis coming to these countries, Azerbaijan is actually a Muslim majority, Shia Muslim majority country. So it was, again, very moving. It was actually, this one was a packed mass. You had 500 people at mass, and that's probably all the Catholics there are in Azerbaijan. I actually did the math. It would have been cheaper to fly them to Rome than to fly the Pope to them. But, you know, as Francis said, you know, we have to be there for everyone. And they would definitely fall under the periphery. Yeah. Pope Francis keeps talking about, you know, the outskirts, reaching out to those who are in the outskirts. And so it was beautiful, you know, despite the emptiness, I think it was beautiful to see the world's most powerful man taking time to be there for the sort of the smallest ones.
It was very, I guess he was very much there as a peacemaker, because those regions have both known their share of violence, and whether it's, you know, intersectarian between themselves or with Russia, certainly a place where the Pope going not as a, you know, there's such suspicion, I think, sometimes among the Orthodox that the Pope is there to try to proselytize, when really he was there as an image of peace.
Definitely. And I mean, he actually had to say, you know, proselytism, it's a scene of ecumenism. You're not, you know, we need to reach out to our brothers in the faith, but that doesn't mean we have to forcibly convert them into becoming Catholics. So, and there was definitely, you know, some political tensions in both trips. In Georgia, as you very well said, with Russia, because Georgia claims there is a part of, you know, 20% of its territories has been occupied by Russia. And the international community has largely acknowledged this. You know, the United States, the European Union have all protested the military presence of Russia in some regions of Georgia. But also in Azerbaijan, you have a country that's, you know, it's a long-standing détente with Armenia, a country the Pope visited earlier in the year over the region of Bokorno-Karabakh. So again, it was trying to, you know, bring peace and bring issues into the table, issues into the attention of the country, but at the same time being very specific and not taking sides, which you know, it's so not always easy to accomplish. But I think in that sense, he had a fantastic trip.
Well, you know,
more important than.
You talk about the Pope traveling to the peripheries. One place that he's not traveling is to Argentina. He said,
"Shut up, Mike! Shut up!
Not in 2017 either. Are the Argentinians getting impatient?"
Yeah, I mean, my family was like calling me. It was like, "What do you mean he's not coming? You promised us he'd come." I'm like, "I said I thought he would come. I didn't promise it." But yeah, that definitely did not make me look good with my family. But it was sort of a low blow. We were all hoping he'd come. We know he's going to do. I mean, he might do some other Latin America trip, which is sort of add salt to the wound because he's in the region. But he just won't come back home. And you know, it's like, come see your sister. Your sister wants to see you.
2018. That's what we're holding on to.
2018. That's what we're going to hope for now. Crossing our fingers.
And if it doesn't happen, Inez, we're going to blame you. Okay.
Hey, come on, I have nothing to do. I did ask him on the plane, like, really, Holy Father, you're not coming yet again? But he's like, well, you know, a lot of things to do.
Inez, we're going to have to wrap it up. We're out of time. Thanks, as always. Really appreciate your work.
No, thank you.
And enjoy that sports conference, and we'll talk to you again soon, okay?
Perfect. Sounds good.
All right.
Bye, Mike.
We'll be back in just a minute. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show. Want to learn more about Breadbox Media? Go to breadboxmedia.com. You can give a listen to some of our different contributors throughout the country if you've not exposed yourself to them or heard their shows, their perspectives, all really, really good stuff across the heartland and the corners of this country. You can check it all out at breadboxmedia.com, including podcasts. You can download the app for your digital device, so you can always have Breadbox Media in your pocket, and subscribe even to the shows through podcast, through Podbean, Google Play, or iTunes. You can also become a friend of your favorite show. If that's me, I'm blushing, by making a monthly contribution, receive access to exclusive online content. Check it all out at breadboxmedia.com. Again, my question of the day, do you think there is a systemic pattern of racial bias in law enforcement in this country? I posted a link to a Vanity Fair piece that cites 18 different studies on this issue that seem to indicate that there is. A couple comments we've gotten on Facebook. Beth says, that's a lot of data. That's a lot of data suggesting a real problem, referencing the Vanity Fair piece of the 18 academic studies and legal rulings and media investigations that I posted. And then Shannon says, I think there's systemic militarization of the police department. I think there is systemic racism in this country. I can't ignore the reality of this just because it's inconvenient for me as a white person. Admitting the reality of this doesn't mean I participate or am at fault for it. I will say that allowing this to continue, whether willfully or through ignorance, only perpetuates it and one day will include others. As I said, we'll have Joan Root, retired police officer, on in the second hour. She'll give us her own law enforcement perspective on the recent shootings. And we'll ask her about this question and get her take on that as well. If you want to chime in, you can call or text 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. You can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. Always enjoy talking to Inez San Martin. You can almost feel her breathlessness in trying to keep up with Pope Francis, I think. There are a lot in the journalistic world that would wish he'd slow down just a hair. It's really pretty remarkable for a guy in his upper 70s with one lung, keeping up the pace. And as she said, going to that earthquake-stricken region just after returning from an exhausting trip to Georgia and Azerbaijan. I'm going to say that as much as possible because I just went to YouTube to figure out how to pronounce Azerbaijan. Uzbekistan, some of those countries that we don't run across. There's one that starts with a TJ, and I'm not sure even how to pronounce that one. But you can sense that she'd like him to slow up a little bit. And also the little bit of the frustration of the Argentinian people that Pope Francis is sort of keeping them guessing and waiting, saying he's not going to come there in 2017 either. And the grief Inez is taking. So funny stuff. Okay, let's get to our What Were You Thinking awards for the day, which we have not yet gotten to. We're running late. Story of my life. Go dumb or go home, our policy. Pascal believed in the grandeur and misery of man. Here's a little of the misery. Police, New Jersey woman stole medic's wallet after boyfriend's death. What? You got to be really at a low point, right? Evidently, her boyfriend was struck and killed. This is from Harrison Township, New Jersey. The incident happened on Sunday. According to police, 25-year-old Brittany Carulli had been allowed to sit in the ambulance in order to grieve the loss of her boyfriend. He had just been struck by a car and killed. She was allowed to sit in the ambulance to stay out of the inclement weather. She could have a safe place to grieve. The medic contacted police later in the day after realizing her wallet was missing from her purse, which was located in the center console of the ambulance she was working in. The medic allegedly told police no one else had access to the ambulance or purse during that time. Carulli was arrested and allegedly admitted to stealing the wallet. It was returned to the medic, though it was missing $120 in cash. So you're overwhelmed with grief at the death of your boyfriend, and you think, I think I'll just lift that wallet. What in heaven's name? Anyway, number two, and it's always, this is an example that not only does crime not pay, it usually does not show up in great intellectual decisions. Evidently, this from Australia, CCTV, closed circuit television, I guess, security cameras, caught deaf, intellectually disabled trio discussing plot to murder housemate, court hears. It's one thing to talk about killing your housemate in such a manner that others may overhear you. It's another thing when there are security cameras filming to use sign language to talk about killing your roommate. These three are accused of murdering their roommate, who suffered a catastrophic head injury when he fell from his second floor apartment. The prosecutor told the court the trio was captured on closed circuit television in the foyer and elevator of the apartment building discussing in sign language a plan to murder Mr. Wright shortly before he was killed. Ms. Fields asked Mr. Ferris, "You want dead or alive, and how die?" And signs that said, "Can strangle neck area, what do you think?" he told the court. Really? Oh, my goodness. So, but the winner, we're going to give the winner, if I can just find the story. Oh, yeah, staff at a nursing home. A center for the disabled in Pueblo, Colorado. At least eight people have been fired due to alleged abuse at a center for the disabled in Pueblo, where staff told investigators that paranormal activity was to blame. The federal investigation found numerous cases of abuse at the Pueblo Regional Center for People with Severe Intellectual Disabilities. A federal report indicates several residents had words like die and kill scratched into their skin. Staffers claim the words appeared by paranormal activity. Another patient was allegedly burned by a hairdryer in order to raise her body temperature. Now, listen, I believe in the demonic. I believe in possession. But I guess I take the position, like the church typically does, there's a lot of things we better rule out first before we get to that. And a home for the disabled, where there's potential abuse for its patients, claiming paranormal activity may be a bit of a stretch. That's all I'm saying. 573-4BREAD-4. If you've got a nominee, maybe even from your own life, it's always fun to laugh at ourselves. or we'll just be laughing with you. That's our story. 573-4BREAD-4. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Always pass along stories. I'm glad to get them. I didn't get to see the debate last night. That's not true. Actually, I saw parts of it. I probably saw about half the debate last night. I have to say, on the whole, I thought I was more impressed overall with Kane and Pence than I was with Clinton and Trump, to be honest with you. But a couple things coming out of the debate last night. Certainly, the interrupting of Tim Kaine has been talked about a lot. He was determined, I guess, to be the aggressor in the debate, and interrupted Governor Pence of Indiana a lot. Kaine certainly has an impressive level of experience when you look at what he's been as a mayor, city councilman, senator, governor. But Mike Pence, of course, also having experience as the governor of Indiana. You know, you got the sense between the two that they're sort of having to do the gymnastics that a lot of voters for their top-of-the-ticket candidates are having to do, trying to defend certain things, because they both seem like people of conscience. And you wonder, have they both, to a certain degree, dampened their conscience in order to join up in their own political ambition with the head of the ticket? I think about that with Tim Kaine, for example. There was an exchange last night. This must have happened after I turned off the debate and went to bed on the issue of abortion. Tim Kaine, for many, many years, presented himself as a pro-life Democrat. Now, I've gotten in arguments with people before over this issue. I've had Rebecca Hamilton on the program, who is a retired legislator, state legislator from the state of Oklahoma, who is a pro-life Democrat and who has been a courageous voice for the sanctity of human life within her own party and against the almost sacramental way that the Democratic Party has treated abortion. She has been a dissenting voice in that, and I think a needed one. I think we need pro-life people on both sides of the aisle. And she is one who has been very courageous in that regard. And so I happen to support and believe in pro-life Democrats. Tim Kaine, though, is not good evidence for my argument, because he long ago, or I guess not that long ago, abandoned his position as a pro-life Democrat, and particularly when he came on board with Hillary Clinton, who is, I think, at this point, the most pro-abortion candidate we've ever had in the history of the Republic. It's particularly when she talks about repealing the Hyde Amendment. And to see Tim Kaine, who trumpets himself as a practicing Catholic, and he grew up going to Catholic schools, went with the Jesuits on mission to Central America, to hear him kind of take the Cuomo defense that he's personally opposed but would never impose and that sort of thing. You're going to have to answer for that, Governor, Senator, because political expediency should never outweigh the sanctity and the dignity of human life from conception to natural death. And on that, I thought Governor Pence spoke quite eloquently. I hope he can convince the top of his ticket to make that issue a priority. We'll be back with more with a new hour. This is The Mike Allen Show, and you're listening to Breadbox Media.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.